Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California campus, and we're streaming live on the web at kuci.org. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today is John Boyne. He's the author of 12 novels for adults, 6 for younger readers, and a collection of short stories. In his native Ireland, he has won 3 Irish Book Awards and has been shortlisted on 13 separate occasions. He's also won or been shortlisted for a host of international literary awards, including a Stonewall Honor Award and a Lambda Literary Award. A regular participant at international literary festivals, he's also been a member of the jury for the International Impact Dublin Literary Award and the Costa Book Award. And in 2015, he chaired the jury for the Scotiabank Giller Prize. His novels have been published in more than 50 languages. His new novel is The Traveler at the Gates of Wisdom, published by Hogarth, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House. And I'm so happy to have him here with us talking from his home in Ireland. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I must say, the first book of yours I read was The Heart's Invisible Furies. And then I, you know, here I'm discovering a new author, and now you have a new book, and now you have all these other books I get to read that I haven't read yet. Let's start with talking about A Traveler at the Gates of Wisdom and how the book came about.
Well, it's a historical novel, I suppose, really, because it begins in the year 1 and it continues, though, into the future in the year 2080. And the last few books I've written have been much more contemporary, but I do have a track record of writing historically based novels. And I wanted to go back to that with this one. I enjoy doing research. I enjoy setting stories in the past. And I had this idea for, you know, could I write a book that was set really across the whole span of time from Roman days up to a space station in the future, and how I would conceive that, how the novel would be structured. And so it took a little bit of time to figure out a plan for it. But I like challenging myself, and I thought it would be an ambitious topic to take on.
Yeah, it covers so much time. I mean, 1 AD to, as you said, space station in 2080. It must have taken a massive amount of research.
Yeah, it did. I often should, because the novel goes through 51 countries as well as that space station. I was choosing a lot of places I had been myself and historical incidents that had interested me to begin with. But I put up a big chart on my wall of my office, really, with the different dates and the countries. And I would love to see, did something interesting happen in, say in the year 420, what was happening in the world? Was there something interesting that I could use in the story? Even though the central of the story is a family, it's one person, one narrator, an artist, but his story takes place in this constantly changing environment. And sometimes I would use that, sometimes I would choose the historical events to reflect what was going on in his life, but sometimes it would just be simply the place rather than the history.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how you decided on the years and the locales, and I am curious if in the editing of the book, if there were sections you had to leave out and why.
Well, the timing-wise, it sort of moves every 40 years or so through time. And no, I didn't leave anything out. I left countries out, but I tried to keep a good balance between the hemispheres and the continents. I wanted to kind of represent as many different places in the world as possible. And that was, you know, if you've got 51 countries, but I think there's 147 in the world. So, you know, you have to make some choices there, which ones. And look, obviously there was some that have to go in, including my own country, Ireland. But it was a lot of fun actually to do it. I think I have quite a mathematical brain anyway. So a complex structure like this with a sort of mathematical bent to it is something that works quite well for me.
Yeah, I was curious because it looks like this book covered or came just after Heart's Invisible Furies. Is that correct?
No, there was another one in the meantime, A Ladder to the Sky.
Okay. All right. Because I was going to say, you know, The Heart's Invisible Furies, I noticed how that book was epic in nature as well, beginning with pre-birth and ending at the end of life. And so I was very curious about then this one and A Ladder in the Sky. I still need to read that one. Does that follow a similar sort of epic?
No, that one is more, it's about a manipulative writer. It's a sort of a Talented Mr. Ripley, but in literary circles. Uh-huh. So it takes place in a much shorter time frame.
I've got to read that one too. I've got to read all your stuff, but I'm curious, you know, I'm always interested with authors, apart from the most current book, do you have a favorite of yours or one that you wrote that, I don't know, that you just felt really encapsulated what you hoped to do and meant to do it off?
I think The Heart's Invisible Furies would be that book. That's the one that, because it's set in Ireland over those 70 years from the end of the war until 2015, the Equal Rights Marriage Referendum. And it references so much of Irish life during that time, changing society, gay rights, gay marriage, going from being such a conservative Catholic country to being a much more liberal, free-thinking place. And it's full of humor as well. And I think the central character is one that people seem to enjoy when they read the book and feel they can relate to. So I think The Heart's Invisible Furies probably for me would be my favorite of my own books.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it. I loved how in A Traveler at the Gates of Wisdom, how there's an Easter egg, at least one that I noticed with Maud Avery's books from The Heart's Invisible Furies showing up in, I think, AD 2016.
I do that quite a bit, actually, through my books, because, as you mentioned earlier, there's between the adults and the kids' books, there's 18 novels. And I do like to kind of bring characters in from other stories, particularly when I've written things set in historical periods. You know, with a book like this one, for example, I could look back at all my books and say, well, you know, I could bring in somebody from everything if I wanted to, because I've got the whole span of time. But I think it's just enjoyable for anybody who is very familiar with the books and who enjoys my writing. And they get to see a little bit of, as you said, a little Easter egg in there.
Yeah, I love that. Well, what came first, writing for kids or adults?
Adults. My first four novels were adult books. And then I wrote The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, which I presented to my agent as a children's book. And it was originally published as a children's book, but it broadened out after that to both kids and adults. But I had never really thought about writing for young people through my teens and early 20s when I was, you know, ambitious about being a writer. It had always been adult books. And now I tend to kind of move back and forth a little bit between them, which is quite good, I find, for my creative brain. And I don't make for the young people's books, I don't make the stories any easier or the language any simpler. Three of those books are set in wartime. One is about a transgender teenager. One is about the death of a parent. So I tend to take quite serious subjects. Children go through, unfortunately, they go through, oftentimes they go through adult experiences well before their time. So that's what I tend to do when I write a book for young people. I take a child and put them at the center of quite an adult experience.
Mm. And in terms of writing you said, you know, when you were a teen, starting to write, did you start to write at a really, really young age? I mean, tell me a little bit about your background.
I actually, from about eight or nine, the thing I wanted to do was write. At that age, even, I found that reading and writing were completely connected to me. I read a lot. I was in the library a lot. My parents had a lot of books around the house. And I always, you know, a lot of other writers I've spoken to about this have a similar thing where I had a sort of a stationery fetish, you know, and I still do. I love like nice notebooks and nice pens.
Yes.
And as a kid, I loved that. And I would take characters from stories that I had read or books I had read, and I would write new stories for them. And when I was about 14 or 15, I really thought to myself, I was pretty sure in my head, this is what I want to do with my life. I didn't know if I was going to be good enough or not, if I would have the talent, but I was very passionate about it and I worked very hard at it. And you know, I spent quite a lot of my teenage years just writing stories. And then I did an English degree in Trinity College Dublin and a creative writing master's in England, in Norwich, when I was in my early 20s. And at that point, you know, I was really taking it seriously and very ambitious. And my dream was always to get a novel published by the time I was 30. And I got one published when I was 29. So I pulled it in just under the just under that mark. But I didn't, like, I didn't seem to have any plan B. Maybe because when you're in your early 20s and so on as well, like your ambitions, you feel sure are going to come true. Or you know, you don't want to have a backup plan. So I don't know what I would have done if it hadn't worked out. But it's just always been the thing I've been most passionate about. And even now, 20 years of publishing and all these books behind me, I still get the same excitement from writing. I still get the same joy from it when I'm lost in the story that I'm working on. It really just, it gives me my sense of self, I think, in the world.
Mm. What about the process of publishing? What's the most exciting part? Is it finishing a book and sending it in? Is it getting back, you know, the text from your editor with, you know, questions, edits? Is it seeing it on the shelf? What's the best part for you?
There's a few different parts that I really enjoy. In the writing itself, I really enjoy the second draft. When you have an actual manuscript that's a big mess, but you know your story is in there somewhere. But the pressure of kind of making it up as you go along, as you do with the first draft, is off you. So I quite enjoy that. I've always enjoyed working with I've had the same editor for, you know, most of my career. And I've always enjoyed working with him. We have a good shorthand and trust each other. And I'm always conscious that anything he says is for the book's sake, you know, not to be unkind or anything. So we work well together. I quite enjoy jacket design. You know, I love when I get that email with, because I don't actually have a very visual brain. And I love when I get the email with, say, 6 or 7 jacket ideas for a book. And you open them up and you have no idea what it's going to look like. And, you know, there's a whole range of ideas. I really enjoy that. And then eventually when the box arrives and the excitement of a new book, holding it in your hands, that never goes away. And I suppose then it finishes up, you know, when you're at, well, unfortunately, this year has been very bad for literary festivals, obviously, with the pandemic. But in normal times, going to festivals, talking about your books with readers, reading on stages, meeting readers afterwards, that's lovely, because then it feels like you're not writing into a void, that there are people out there who actually enjoy your book, maybe want to talk to you about it. And I must admit now, during 2020, I've really missed that part of the writing life.
Mm. Yeah, in terms of that, what's your launch like this year with The Traveler at the Gates of Wisdom? What are you doing?
Almost nothing, you know, because the book came out in the UK earlier this month, and it came out in the US a couple of weeks later. And normally I would have been on book tours in both countries and, you know, going around various cities and reading in bookshops and doing interviews and so on. And I haven't done any of that. I mean, I've been doing Zoom interviews and things like that, but I haven't had to leave the house really. And and it feels very strange, because it just feels like I'm so accustomed to going out with a new book and choosing a section to read and reading it, you know, multiple times over several months, maybe. Yeah, it is. It's been very unusual for me to be publishing a book in that way. But that said, I think it's been, even because I have been around for a while, and I do have, I'm fortunate enough to have a good number of readers. It's been a lot harder, I think, maybe for debut novelists or second time novelists who are trying to get their book out there, you know, into the public consciousness, and can't do the things that we normally do. For anybody publishing a debut novel, it must have been a very hard time not to be able to do a nice book launch for your family and friends and kind of enjoy the excitement of becoming a published novelist.
Yeah. But I will say that there are so many virtual events, and now there are newsletters going out with sort of like, here's what's going on this week, where you can, you know, just stop in at different events around the world. Yeah. And it's just, you know, I wonder if when this is all over, if part of that remains, you know, where people are doing things, you know, touring as they used to, but also, you know, taking part in all the virtual things going on.
Well, I mean, one of the interesting thing, actually about a month or two ago, one of my earlier books came out in Mexico, and I was doing 7 interviews for various papers, and I did them all over Zoom in my back garden, basically. And in other times, maybe I would have been over in Mexico for a week doing those and doing readings. And in some, you know, before the pandemic, you know, the big thing that everybody talked about, of course, was saving the planet and climate change and everything. And, you know, I think you can make a case there for you don't really need to get on a plane and go across the world to do things that you can do from the comfort of your own home. Now, I would prefer to do the events with audiences and with readers and sign books and talk to readers. But I think when it comes to maybe press interviews and so on, it might change like that it's, we've realized we can actually just do these things, you know, face to face over a computer screen and help the environment while we're doing it.
I'd love to hear you read from A Traveler at the Gates of Wisdom. Would you do that?
Sure. I'll just read the first couple of pages. So it opens in Palestine in 81. On the night that I was born, my father Marinus left our home while my mother was in labor, and over the 8 hours that followed, slaughtered a dozen infant boys, the sons of our neighbors and friends, each one under the age of 2 years. He owned 4 swords, including a pair of gladii and an ornamental sika that had been handed down through 3 generations of our family. But he chose the smallest weapon in his arsenal, a triangular dagger with a wooden handle and silver blade known as a parazonium, to end each of the baby's lives. A ruby jewel of considerable value lay at the center of the quillion, its liquid blush ready to reflect the blood that spilled from the bodies of the children. A man of duty, he did not hesitate as he marched from door to door, searching each house for hidden nurslings before plunging his knife into the heart of every boy he found. And while mothers screamed in horror and rained curses down upon his head, fathers stood silently in corners, mute and impotent, knowing that if they dared to speak, the blade would surely find its way across their throats before their sentence came to an end. Older siblings trembled in fear as they watched Marinus go about his dark business, soiling themselves, frightened that they too were about to face the judgment of the gods for some unspecified crime. But no, once the babe had been dispatched from this world for the next, my father barely glanced in their direction before making his way to the next house and the next after that, for there were more babies to discover and more lives to bring to a premature end. After each murder, he wiped the blade clean on his tunic, the fabric growing increasingly discolored as the sun began to peep over the horizon in the east, a fiery witness to unspeakable crimes. And soon the gray disappeared beneath an incarnadine coat. Of course, Marinus was not the only man engaged in sanguinous misadventures that night. More than 30 other soldiers had been deployed by King Herod to the towns that surrounded Bethlehem, until more than 300 infant boys were put to death for the crime of being a potential king of the Jews. When my father returned home in the early morning, his spirit died with a barbaric tint that could never be erased. I was suckling at my mother's breast, and he placed a trembling hand upon my skull, resting it there for a moment as he gave me his blessing and begged forgiveness from the immortals atop Mount Olympus. When he took it away, a trace of blood was left in its wake, a deadly deposit. And I've always wondered whether some residue of his crimes remained indelibly upon my soul, a tattoo invisible to all but the eyes of the gods, a reminder of the massacre of the innocents that was taking place as I filled my lungs with air for the first time.
Thank you so much. That was John Boyne reading from A Traveler at the Gates of Wisdom, published by Hogarth. I'm curious, you know, a lot of people die in this book, and as they did in The Heart's Invisible Furies as well. And how are you with killing off characters? I mean, that seems to be one of the hardest things for writers to do. You create characters you love, and then some of them have to go.
That's part of the job, I think. In this book, because it's set over so many years, I knew there was going to be a lot of death, a lot of bloodshed, particularly because so much of it is set during quite violent times. I think the disappointing thing sometimes is when you have a character that you really like, but you do have to kill him or her in order to serve the story, because the story is what's most important. Hmm. So, you know, that phrase, kill your darlings.
Right.
That's really what it's about, I think. And but you have to do it. You know, you have to do it, because otherwise the novel isn't, the narrative isn't going to hang together correctly. So, you know, they do their job and then you bump them off.
Well, as you were reading, I was also wondering, because you have such a lovely voice, do you read your own audiobooks?
I've never have. And it's nice of you to say, and a few people have said that to me, why don't I? And I was actually thinking recently that maybe for my next one I will, because a few people have been quite complimentary to me about my reading. So I might next time. I never have before.
Hmm, that would be nice. Back to this book, I noticed that fathers and sons is quite a theme running through it, as was in The Hearts of Visible Furies. And I keep bringing that up because so far that's the only other book of yours that I've read. Talk about theme and whether that's intentional or whether you leave theme up to the reader to come to.
I think with most writers, themes that repeat through books happen in the subconscious, that you don't really set out to do it, but like we're all interested in particular things and they kind of resurface time and again for a writer through their books. I've noticed, for example, that there's in almost all my books, there's a moment of great disloyalty between two people where the one person that you've trusted the most in the world lets you down. It happens in this book and becomes a big revenge epic because of it. And it's happened in almost all my books. I've also done a lot of juxtaposing quite a naive, innocent character next to a figure of great authority. I did that in The House of Special Purpose, where I had a bodyguard, a young bodyguard, and the Tsar of Russia. I did it in the book on The Bounty with a young cabin boy and Captain Bligh. So I quite like juxtaposing power with complete lack thereof. So I think in this book, again, because it's set over such a long period and there are so many different storylines, I would suspect that a lot of my recurring themes show up in the book, but I don't sit there as a writer planning to put them in. I don't sort of have a chart with that thinking, now I want to have, you know, an important father-son or mother-son relationship or that moment of disloyalty. It just seems to gradually and spontaneously appear in the text itself.
What do you begin with? I mean, do you begin with a character? Do you begin with a situation? Do you begin with a conflict or maybe, you know, something happening in the world and you go, you know, I really have to spend some time with this, you know?
Usually it starts with like a little idea, an idea for how a story might begin. And then I wonder, well, you know, what would happen with that? And I don't plot novels in advance. I don't sit down and, you know, write scene by scene all the things that will happen. And every writer works differently when it comes to this, as I'm sure you know. For me, I prefer to just start with an idea, start writing, and see where it takes me. And that seems to work well for me. I let the novel open up before me on the page. And sometimes I find I put things in that I don't know why they're there, but they reveal themselves later on. I often feel that it's all there at the back of my head anyway, and that I'm sort of chipping away to get to it. But I don't like to know too much about a novel before starting it. I just like to know the basic idea. What is it I'm writing about? What is it about that idea that interests me? And with this, you know, the idea really was that that over time, even though the world keeps changing, technology, industry, global barriers, everything changes over 2,000 years. That our human emotions never change. That's what I wanted to explore in the book. The idea that anything that we might feel, you know, if I today fell in love or was grieving or something like that, that my emotions would be the exact same as any other man or woman at any other time in history. Now, I didn't know whether that was true or not, but I wanted to to explore it in the writing to see, is it true? If I was putting my characters into these situations at different times, would they feel different, or in the writing, would it seem different than we would today? So that's how I like to start, with just what seems to me to be a good idea, and then just let it play out in front of me.
So you don't have the ending. You're not writing toward an ending.
No, but I find that usually about two-thirds of the way through, because you're thinking about the book a lot, not just while you're writing it, but you know, while you're just going about your daily business, you know, doing the laundry or eating dinner or something. I find about two-thirds of the way through, the ending comes to you. And there's an ending that just seems so natural. And that's what I like. I don't want to sort of force a twist ending or surprise. I want an ending to feel like it's natural and authentic to the reader, but that it will be satisfying as well. So, you know, in something like The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, that ends on a very bleak note. But it's the only ending a book like that could have. A novel like this actually ends on a very optimistic note. And again, I felt, as I was coming to the end of it, there had been so much darkness in the book that because we end on a space station in the future, that optimism would be there, that the world would be, people who are there, we're starting again, and all the mistakes that we've made across these 2,000 years, they would try not to replicate. So I'm a very instinctive writer in that way. I trust my gut. If it feels that that's the right way to progress, then that's what I will do.
Mm. Yeah, I love the last chapter. I mean, I really loved it. I loved the end of the penultimate chapter too, just with that one Trump line. Trump. Pardon me?
That's the Donald Trump chapter.
That was a great chapter. I mean, that,
well, I was saving the U.S. for there, because I really liked the idea of using the U.S. on the night of the last election and to kind of get all the cast together and, you know, sit them down in front of a television. And of course, as we know, the evening starts with everybody thinking one thing is going to happen and ends with something completely different happening. And I liked the idea of sort of presenting that on the page and you know, how the characters would react to it.
Yeah, as it was, right? That's one of those nights you always remember. Where were you on that night? You know, who were you with?
And at what moment in the night do you go, this isn't going according to plan, is it?
This is so totally not what I expected. Yeah. And then, the epilogue is wonderful too. And it really does kind of end on that, a real glimmery note. It was, I was thinking about, as I read that, I was thinking about how they say you should begin with a really strong first chapter to get people reading and end with a really strong last chapter so readers will want to read your next book. And do you think about that? Does that ever go into your consciousness when you're writing? I
mean, you do really want those to be strong, but you want the whole thing to be strong, really. But you do want to grip people quite quickly. But again, you know, I know, like John Irving, for example, doesn't begin a novel until he knows what his last sentence is going to be. And with that last sentence in mind, he knows what he's doing, so to speak. So I think for any like aspiring writer listening to this, you find what works best for you. And once you have that, you tend not to abandon it, because that's the way your novel gets written.
You know, you worked with John Irving, didn't you?
I'm very good friends with John Irving. He's been kind of a mentor to me over the years. When I published my first novel in 2000, I sent him a copy of it with a fan letter, because he had really inspired me as a young man, and I absolutely adore his books. And he very kindly wrote back to me and read the book. And then we became friends over the last 20 years, very good friends. And we've been on stages together quite a lot. And I still kind of, when I have been on a stage with them, I still kind of have to sort of pinch myself. it did work out this. but he's always been he's a lovely, lovely man, but he's an inspiring writer, I think.
Do you remember who your influences were when you were a kid, who you loved or what you loved reading as a kid that kind of maybe helped you decide, this is what I'm going to do?
Well, as a teenager, definitely. One of the things that really inspired me was growing up in Dublin, there was a whole generation of Irish writers who were really coming to the fore and making names for themselves. People like Roddy Doyle, Colm Tobin, Colm McCann, so many of them really. And they were winning prizes. They were having movies made of their books. We're a small country. Now, we do have a great literary tradition, but the number in that generation that preceded mine and their success, their continuing success, and the quality of their work did make me go at sort of 14, 15, say, did make me think, well, this is not an impossible dream. This is something that is definitely possible. If the guy down the road can do it, you know, why can't I? Mm-hmm. But other than that, I got into Charles Dickens at quite a young age, around the age of 11 or 12, particularly the orphan books, David Copperfield and Oliver Twist, Nicholas Nickleby. I always liked reading about orphans. And in my books for young readers, in fact, I nearly always get rid of the parents quite early on. I always liked books where young characters were the masters of their own story, responsible for their own destiny. And I got very into those, like as a young age to get into Dickens. But I got very into that big epic storytelling. And then it's no surprise then at sort of 15, 16, I started reading John Irving's books because of course he himself has always talked about his own debt to Charles Dickens and his own love for Dickens's work.
Do you read fiction while you're writing?
I do. I know there's a lot of writers who don't and find it difficult to, but I actually wouldn't be able to not. I mentioned earlier how reading and writing were always very connected to me. They still are. You know, when I'm, say, at home and I've got like a completely, you know, the day is my own to work, I don't just see the writing as part of my workday. I see the reading as part of it. I love reading, but I also like to keep up with, you know, what my peers are writing, what's new, what people are talking about. I really try to keep in touch with it. And I see that as almost like part of my job, but a very enjoyable part of my job. And because I do take part in a lot of festivals, it's always nice to be able to engage in conversations about contemporary literature and what you've liked recently, what impressed you.
What have you liked recently? What has impressed you?
Well, this year, two books would stand out so far. I'd say one is Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reid. Do you know that novel?
I don't.
It's terrific. It's an American American writer. And the premise of it is this young woman who is a nanny. She's a young black woman. She's a nanny to a white child. And she goes to a supermarket in the opening chapter with the child. And somebody basically says to her, you know, who are you with that child? You know, are you kidnapping her? And it goes from there. And then there's an Irish writer called Rob Doyle, whose third novel came out this year called Threshold, which is it's a quasi kind of autobiography fiction about drugs and sex and all the things that people do when they're very young. And it's a mind-blowing novel, not the kind of novel I can write myself, but it really captured me. So those two, anyway, are two that I really liked.
Excellent, thank you. Back to A Traveler at the Gates of Wisdom, I wanted to say, you know, when we were talking about theme, I was thinking when I began reading it and as I started going through the years that it, for me, it was also about reincarnation. I wondered if that ever figured in. I mean, I thought, is this the same character kind of coming back, you know, year after year, decade after decade?
There is an element of that, but I didn't want the voice to just be a reincarnation every time. It's more that every time the new narrator picks it up in a new country at a new time, they themselves have gone through the same experiences as everybody who has gone before. But I didn't want to kind of specifically say, well, it's about reincarnation. Because it's not. It's more about the universality of experience.
Yeah, that makes sense. The cycle of life, you know, I just I found it. Yeah, it's so fascinating what you did here. And you have been so prolific. Do you have any projects that you've put aside or have you published everything you've written?
Other than the two novels I wrote before my first novel was published, I think pretty much every writer has a couple of early things on the computer. that should never see the light of day. other than that, no, I published everything really from then on. But I wouldn't consider that wasted time either, because no writing is wasted, and I wouldn't have been able to write my first published novel had I not written those two before it, because they taught me things about structure and narrative and dialogue and character and so on. But no, I don't think I've ever set aside a project. It wouldn't be like me, to be honest. When I start something, I feel pretty sure I can commit the next 12 to 18 months of my life to it. And if I struggle somewhere along the way, that means that I'm not kind of breaking into it the way that I need to. And I will solve that riddle rather than just putting it aside and starting something new.
Do you have the same process for every book? Do you, spend a certain amount of time thinking about what you're going to write, and then spend a certain amount of time writing it, and then a certain amount of time maybe revising or giving it to readers? I mean, how does your process go?
It is a process that I tend to repeat. I find that when I'm coming to the end of writing a novel, the idea for another one is kind of bubbling in my head, and it's sort of jumping up and down and saying, this is the idea to work on next. I don't like to spend too much time not getting words down on the page. So I would start fairly soon, and I try to get a first draft done in, you know, maybe 4 or 5 months, and just work long hours every day, just keep the story going. I don't worry too much about the language in it, or if I'm getting my facts right or whatever. You know, I just kind of try to get a story down so that I have a manuscript to work from. And then, as I mentioned earlier, I love then the subsequent drafts of chiseling away at that and getting it done. But I find that's generally the way that I work. I don't really take any time off. I don't really want any time off, to be honest with you. You know, when I finish a book, when it sits done, I feel great excitement about starting something completely different. And, you know, it's going to be about, usually when you dot your last I and cross your last T of the novel that you've been writing, it's going to be a good maybe 9 months before it's in the bookshops. So I don't want to sit around doing nothing during that time. I like to be well ahead on the next project.
Hmm. Do you have readers? Do you have readers for your work before it gets to your editor?
No, I don't give it to anybody except my agent and my editor. And even then, I only give it to them when I'm maybe 7 or 8 drafts in, when I feel I can't see the wood for the trees anymore. I just don't like to. I prefer my friends and family to read it when it's in book form, maybe because it's sort of, I don't know, it feels more legitimate. I'm not asking for suggestions, you know, at that point. It is what it is. So I don't really want that kind of input. I really just give it to my agent and editor, and because, as I mentioned, you know, we've worked together for such a long time, we can get the thing done pretty well between us.
Well, how has it been writing now in the middle of this pandemic? I mean, I don't know if before this you would have, you know, during the writing day, you would take off and, you know, get out of your office or out of your house, yes, wherever you write, and take a breather, and how that's changed, and maybe how it's changed your writing.
It didn't change it too much, because I work from home anyway. It didn't affect it that much. The only thing that affected it, I suppose, was those, like, I'm sure we've all had times during it where we really just felt a bit depressed by the whole thing, and, you know, not being able to meet our friends or our family, or, you know, go for a meal or a drink or a movie or whatever. And so there was certainly times where, like, everybody, I felt a bit low and sort of thought, God, you know, I'm done with this coronavirus. I'm ready for it to go. But I recognize I didn't have it as difficult as a lot of people, because I am accustomed to working from home and I can do my job from home. In general, I think it was okay.
Mm. Well, you know, and sort of as a follow-up, this was brought up the other day. I was talking with an author friend, and he said that he felt that anybody writing now, working on a novel today, during this time, should in some way acknowledge the pandemic in their writing and in their projects. And I wonder how you feel about that. I mean, do you feel like, you know, after this is over, it's just going to be sort of a, you know, a blink of an eye, and we won't think much about it? Do you think it should show up in books in some way or another?
It's a tricky one. Actually, somebody was asking me about this the other day, and I thought it's a really tricky question, because, somebody had asked me, with this book, with A Traveler at the Gates of Wisdom, if I was writing it this year, and mm-hmm. was including a 2020 chapter, what I've included the virus. But I am writing a book which is set next year, and I'm not including it. The world that I'm using is, it's just set in London over the course of a week, but it's set in sort of regular times as such. I'm not sure going forward, like if this, God forbid, if this continues for years and years, it will have to start showing up in fiction. But I guess I felt, I feel right now, I don't want to write about it. I don't want to read about it. I'm so fed up with it. and I think maybe readers will feel the same way. So I have been thinking about the fact that this book that I'm writing at the moment, which I'm on draft four of, there's no mention of it. Nobody's wearing face masks. It's just set in the normal day-to-day world. And whether that will seem unrealistic in a year's time, let's hope it doesn't. Let's hope it seems perfectly realistic.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting, you know, how it's going to show up. I think after 9/11, it seemed that in some novels, you know, there was some acknowledgement of what had happened, but then it kind of faded out.
Yeah, I think I think you need a bit of distance from it. You know, I think maybe sort of in 5 years' time, people can look back at it and it will find its way naturally into stories, or it will inspire certain stories. But, you know, I find the idea of just kind of writing scenes where every 5 minutes somebody's putting a face mask on a bit dull.
What about technology? When you're writing a novel that takes place in current day, are you bringing in technology, or are you trying to keep it out? You know, cell phones now, whereas maybe 25 years ago it was telephones, and you know.
I've usually kept it out, but actually I'm, again, in the book I'm writing at the moment, it's really all about that, because the book I'm writing is really about social media and how it affects people and in a negative way, and the way that people behave on social media that they would not necessarily behave in normal day-to-day life. So I'm kind of exploring that in this book at the moment, how technology has affected our emotions and our civility towards each other, our basic decency.
Speaking of which, social media, I wanted to ask you if you're involved, if it's important to you or important to your publisher for you to be out there on Twitter or wherever, just interacting with readers.
I think it is something publishers like, but I actually recently deactivated my Twitter account, which is the only social media that I have or that I had. And I've been on Twitter for about 10 years. And to be honest with you, I just got to the point where I thought, I don't feel happy when I'm on it. I don't feel comfortable. I don't like the idea of people being able to just directly message. And you know, you can get 20 messages and 19 of them can be really lovely. And it's that one mean, nasty message that can just throw your day completely and upset you. And I just decided recently, you know, I don't know why I make myself available to them. it doesn't seem, and maybe because I am writing a novel about it, you know, I've been thinking so much about it that I just thought I've had enough. And so I deleted my account, and I feel like I can breathe easier, you know, not knowing what people are saying or not. Not that people are saying that much about me, I'm not that important, but that, you know, it's still... I always found this sort of nervous anxiety when I would look to see what was on my notifications, just in case there was something, you know, abusive. And who needs that in their life? You know,
right.
Life is hard enough without inviting it on ourselves.
What about reviews then? Will you look at reviews, or do you have your agent or editor sending you reviews they want you to read?
I make it very clear to agent, publisher, and editor, the week or two before the book comes out, don't send me anything, don't tell me anything. And I just don't like to, I don't like to read them. I just don't like to know. I feel that a writer knows the value of their own work and whether you've achieved what you set out to achieve. And you don't need somebody to tell you it's a masterpiece or a travesty to prove that. You know yourself. So No, and at times it's been hard to steer clear of it because of social media. But now that I'm not on it, I mean, short of actually going to a shop and picking up a newspaper, there's no way I would see one anyway. But my publicists and everything are under strict instructions. I don't care even if it's an absolute rave, even if somebody says it's the greatest novel ever written in the history of the universe, I don't want it. You know, just don't send it on to me. I guess the first I ever see of them is when the paperback edition comes out. And then, you know, there'll be little quotes from reviews maybe in the on the jacket or in the first page of the paperback. But then, of course, they'll only be the positive ones anyway.
That's right.
So then I can fool myself into thinking that they were all just delightful.
You know, I wanted to, before we go, I wanted to talk about being a literary citizen, being a good literary citizen. It's something I talk with my students about a lot. You offer a scholarship to Irish students, and I'm curious how that came about for you and what you think about or what being a literary citizen means for you.
That's actually quite important to me. I offered that scholarship at the University of East Anglia, which was the university I went to do my creative writing degree. And it's on that course that I offered. And when I was there, I was age 22 and I was pretty much flat broke. And I really, really struggled that year to, you know, just buy lunch. And a few years back, UEA gave me an honorary doctorate. And I was really touched by it. And I was thinking, well, what can I do to sort of like say thank you? So I thought I would do this. And so there's almost always an Irish student on that writing course. So I would offer, it's a 5,000 euro prize, which pays their fees, which would help, you know, a young writer. But outside of that, I think it's important never to criticize other writers publicly. I don't like when I see writers criticizing each other. And not so much, I think, you know, if somebody writes an honest book review, that's not so much criticism. I mean, when people in interview or something say, you know what, you know, I can't stand, or, you know, I think there's enough people who are going to attack anyway without doing it to each other. I think you should always be supportive. And I think when you've achieved a certain level of success, you should be supportive of new writers, debut writers. You should, you know, be willing to read books and give quotes if you like that book. Don't just give them out randomly to everybody who asks, but be willing to read the work. Every little bit of help can change somebody's career trajectory. So, I think it's the same as in anything else in life. I think it's just being decent, you know, just being a nice person and not trying to achieve success by denigrating others. And there are people, and we know who, I'm sure we could both, you know, if we were sitting having a beer somewhere, name some names, but there are people who seem to just always be denigrating others. And I don't see the need for that.
Yeah, you know, sometimes, you know, I find students or others will bring up certain writers, and I find myself just, you know, nodding and smiling, and even if I might have a story about that writer that isn't so nice, it's like, why say it? You know, there's no reason to say it.
And of course, it brings up the, you know, the age old question about separating the artist from the art anyway.
That, right.
To put those two things in different categories. But yeah, I think there's nothing to be gained by just publicly slagging somebody off, you know.
No. You know, something else I wanted to ask you about as well before we go is, you know, when you hit a wall, if you are blocked, if you reach a point in a book where you feel stuck or lost or somehow all written out, what do you do? How do you get through it? Or do you not encounter those periods?
No, I encounter it, but I try to write through it. I try to just put down a sentence and see where it takes me. And then there are some days it's just not happening. And you just say, you know what, today I'm done. And you just go lie on the sofa and watch Netflix. And sometimes, you know, just going for a walk, exercise can rejuvenate you. And as you go for a walk, the idea of what, like whatever is blocking, you know, the story will come to you as you walk. But I don't like to do it too often. I wouldn't like some days, yeah, as I say, you just have to say, I'm downing my tools today and I'm just going to stop for the day. But you don't want to do that sort of 2-3 days in a row or the book will never get written. So, you know, a lot of writing is just about that kind of discipline and focus. and not giving yourself the luxury of writer's block. It's that, you know, I always think it's, you know, most people, like, they get up, they don't say to themselves, will I bother going to work today? You get up and you go to work without thinking about it. And it should be the same, really, for a writer, that if you are a full-time writer, you shouldn't be thinking about it. You should just get up and go to your desk at the usual time and start writing. That's how books are written.
That's how they get done.
Yeah.
Any tips for the writers listening? Any last words that perhaps something we didn't touch on that?
I think writing groups are very helpful. I think having an audience for your work when you're starting out, because, and not just because it's good for your work, but actually you learn so much from reading other people's work and going into a room to discuss it. And because you recognize, even I've taught creative writing classes where I've been reading a student's work, and I can recognize a mistake that's going on in the writing. And oftentimes I can think to myself, do you know, I'm doing that myself actually in something. And you learn a lot from reading other people. So I think creative writing classes, writing groups, book clubs, all of that are really, really helpful for the creative mind. That would probably be my biggest tip.
Thank you. And thank you for spending all this time with me. It's been a great pleasure. And I love your work, and I can't wait to read more of it. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was John Boyne, and his new book is A Traveler at the Gates of Wisdom. If you just tuned in, or you tuned in, you know, want to hear the show all over again, it will soon be on iTunes and Stitcher. If you go to iTunes, subscribe to the show, subscribe to Writers on Writing. And when we upload the show, it'll arrive in your podcast file or wherever your shows arrive on your phone or computer. Thank you so much for listening. The musical intro and outro is by Travis Barrett. You can find more of his music on Spotify. And remember to stay in the chair or standing before your standing desk. Crazy.
your skin once again. More permanent than the couch you kept clear for a friend. When are you moving out so I can sleep in your bed? No need to pretend that we brought separate air mattresses. My walls are full of watercolors you painted. Of them when they're dead, and we'll live while this world crashes down. Oh, we'll live. No one else can do that for us now. The landfills are full. So let's throw all our shit in the lake. 5 billion years, but the last 100 were a mistake. When are we moving on? I hear Mars looks great in the spring. Save us all, Elon. Our souls can thaw while we freeze. But we'll live while this world crashes. This world crashes down.